Chapter 13. From the Afghanistan Counterterrorism Mission to the Camp David Near Miss. I knew what I wanted to achieve in Afghanistan, and Trump's other senior advisors shared my two objectives. Tied for first, they were 1. Preventing the potential resurgence of ISIS and Al-Qaeda and their attendant threats of terrorist attacks against America, and 2. Remaining vigilant against the nuclear weapons programs in Iran on the west and Pakistan on the east. This was the counterterrorism platform we wanted to pursue in early 2019. The hard part was getting Trump to agree and then stick with his decision. If these objectives were presented poorly or timed badly, we risked another outburst in which Trump would demand we withdraw everyone immediately. Not presenting them meant withdrawal by default. Zalmay Khalilzad's ongoing negotiations with the Taliban constituted another layer of complexity. Pompeo believed he was carrying out Trump's mandate to negotiate a deal lowering the U.S. troop presence to 0. I thought this was clearly bad policy. In theory, the U.S. government opposed any such arrangement unless it was conditions-based, meaning we would go to 0 only if 1. There were no terrorist activities in the country, 2. ISIS and Al-Qaeda were barred from establishing operating bases, and 3. We had adequate means of verification. I thought this was touchingly naive, much like the Pentagon's views on arms control. We make a deal with some gang of miscreants, and they adhere to it. How nice. From the outset, Pompeo insisted it was the Pentagon that wanted a deal with the Taliban to diminish threats to U.S. personnel as we reduced our presence. Without such an agreement, the risks to the shrinking U.S. forces were too great. But again, I thought this was an almost childlike view. I never understood why such a deal gave us any real protection from a group of terrorists we had never trusted. If the Taliban, ISIS, and Al-Qaeda concluded from the plain evidence of palpable U.S. troop drawdowns that we were withdrawing, and that raised risks to our diminishing forces, what would those terrorists conclude from a piece of paper that expressly said we were going to 0 by October 2020? Conditions-based, in the Afghan context, was like an opiate. It made some of us, not including me, feel good, but it was merely a temporary, ultimately hollow experience at best. I doubted there was any deal with the Taliban we should find acceptable, given their track record. If total withdrawal was the target, violations of the conditions would not change that outcome, given Trump's view. Once we were on the nosedive to 0, that's where we would finish. But if continuing negotiations bought us time to prepare and then maintain a sustainable counterterrorism presence, then play on. Shanahan, Dunford, Pompeo, and I all believed that the sooner we could brief Trump on how such operations would work in practice, the better. A briefing was scheduled for Friday, March 15th, and preparations for it began in earnest. Knowing how much was at stake, we had a prep session in the tank on the Friday before. Curiously, Pompeo had John Sullivan attend in his stead. Perhaps he didn't want to reveal what the actual state of play in diplomacy with the Taliban was before the Trump briefing, which would be consistent with his practice of sharing as little about the negotiations as he could. I wasn't bothered by his absence because I had concluded Afghan diplomacy wouldn't matter much in the long run anyway. My horizon was more limited. How to make the Defense Department's presentation to Trump the following Friday as effective as possible, thereby persuading him we needed to keep substantial counterterrorism resources in country. Typical of its briefings, the Pentagon had prepared charts and slides, making everything more complicated than necessary, even when they were conveying good news to Trump, such as the substantial reductions in personnel and costs the military would achieve. I urged Shanahan and Dunford to pay close attention to Trump's reactions as they briefed, and not simply bull ahead reading the slides and charts. This was the Mattis style, and I had heard the stories, true or not, of Trump tuning out long, exhaustive briefings by McMaster. No need to go through that again. I thought everyone agreed, but the test would come the following week. On the morning of March 15th, Trump called Ethiopian President Abiy Ahmed Ali, who became the 2019 Nobel Peace Prize winner in October, to express condolences for the recent Ethiopian air crash, leading to the worldwide grounding of all Boeing 737 MAX airplanes. While Trump and I were talking, waiting for the call to go through, he raised Afghanistan and said, "We've got to get out of there." It was not an auspicious way to start the day. I called him back after the Abiy call to explain that the briefing would largely consist of the Pentagon's showing how it had refined the Afghan mission based on his instructions to reduce the U.S. presence. "It won't hurt the negotiations, will it?" he asked, worried that pulling down our numbers would indicate weakness, and I said it would not. He asked that I ride with him in the Beast to the Pentagon along with Pence, which provided another chance to take his temperature and address any concerns, but the conversation during the ride turned out to be largely about North Korea. In the tank, Shanahan said the briefing would explain how to maintain our counterterrorism and other wherewithal now that the Taliban was negotiating. Trump immediately interrupted to ask, "Do we weaken our hand in the negotiations by saying we're dropping our forces?" I had called both Shanahan and Pompeo right after my earlier exchange with Trump, and their answers were well prepared. They said the timing was actually perfect. As is often the case, decimating the opposition often makes the survivors more eager to negotiate. Trump then discoursed on how bad previous commanders had been, unfair but a frequent complaint, not to mention Mattis's performance, despite Trump's having approved the rules of engagement Mattis requested. "How are the negotiations going?" Trump asked, but cut almost immediately into Pompeo's response, raising the endemic corruption among Afghan officials, especially Afghan President Ghani and his purported riches, although unfortunately confusing Ghani with former President Hamid Karzai, as he did constantly. Hopefully unnoticed, I signaled Dunford to jump in to say that the reduction in violence accomplished by our current strategy meant we could fulfill our ongoing counterterrorism and other missions in practice with reduced resources, even without agreement from the Taliban. "We listened to you," Dunford said to Trump, which was a good line in the post-Mattis era. Dunford also said we could handle any weakening of the Afghan government if that occurred and focus on Al-Qaeda and ISIS, the real terrorist threats to America. I pointed out that weak central government was Afghanistan's historical default position and would be nothing new for the inhabitants. Dunford further explained the need to maintain a counterterrorism presence for the broader region. As he launched into his charts and slides to show how our Afghan operations would be staffed and costed, Trump said, "There are still a lot of people there." But fortunately, he went on to say, "Having no one is dangerous because they, the terrorists, tend to form there and knock down buildings," which was exactly the point. Trump repeated one of his hobby horses, namely that it was cheaper to rebuild the World Trade Center than to fight in Afghanistan, inconveniently ignoring the loss of life in the 9/11 attacks, not just the cost of rebuilding. It also ignored the reality that a Trump withdrawal followed by a terrorist attack would be devastating politically. Dunford pressed on, saying our military pressure kept the terrorists from reconstituting and was like an insurance policy. He had no precise timetable in mind, but the Pentagon would allow the diplomatic reconciliation process to set the timing. I thought we were approaching dangerous ground here, again opening the question of whether we should be in Afghanistan at all. The discussion meandered around for a while, with Trump asking me why we were fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan but not Venezuela, which at least showed everyone else in the room what he really wanted to do. Following more chatter, Shanahan turned to the cost reductions that maintaining the counterterrorism capability would entail, but before he got too far, Trump broke in to complain about Congress's refusal to fund the Mexico border wall. Then he was off. Why can't we just get out of Syria and Afghanistan? I never should have agreed to the other 200 in Syria, and it's really 400 anyway. Dunford explained that other NATO countries would hopefully contribute to the multilateral observation force in Syria, and Trump responded, "We pay for NATO anyway," which in turn produced another riff about Erdogan and what he was doing in Turkey. Then, after literally 45 seconds back on Afghanistan, Trump asked, "Why are we in Africa?" He soon made it clear he wanted out of Africa altogether, expounding for some time on our $22 trillion national debt, followed by the problems of our balance of trade deficits, followed by complaining again about how Nigeria received $1.5 billion annually in foreign aid, as he said the president of Nigeria had confirmed to him in an earlier visit, even though they wouldn't buy U.S. farm products. After more Africa discussion, Trump returned to Afghanistan, saying, "Get it, the annual cost, down to $10 billion, a figure derived from the resources required by our thinking for the continuing U.S. presence, and get it down fast." That led to the costs of U.S. military bases in South Korea and how much Seoul should contribute to defraying the expenses. Trump said happily we had extracted $500 million more from the South in negotiations at the end of 2018. It was actually around $75 million, as pretty much everyone else in the tank knew. He still wanted the South Korea payment to equal U.S. costs plus 50%. And whatever our political differences with Iraq, Trump reminded us that, having paid so much to build our bases there, we were not leaving. After a bit less than an hour, as we were wrapping up, Trump asked Dunford in front of everyone, "How's our acting secretary doing?" Dunford, obviously stunned, came back quickly to offer, "Here's where I say what a great job he's doing." And everyone laughed. I just wanted to get out the tank's door, so Pompeo and I simply stood up and started pulling papers together. Others then rose, and we all walked to the Pentagon's river entrance, where the motorcade was waiting. Pence and I rode with Trump in the Beast, where the conversation was mostly on the MAX 737 grounding. Back in the West Wing, I called Shanahan to congratulate him on the outcome and say he should take the rest of the day off. It wasn't pretty, as I also told Dunford when I called him a few minutes later, but it was definitely a win. Dunford said, "Trump now believes we're listening to him, which he didn't believe before," which was emphatically correct. Pompeo, with whom I spoke the next day, also believed the briefing was a win. The problem still not resolved, however, was the Taliban negotiations. At a breakfast on March 21st, Shanahan and Dunford brought a chart showing several ways the State Department had departed from what the Pentagon believed were the agreed negotiating guidelines. Most troubling to me was that the State Department's negotiating objectives were completely detached from what I considered to be our real objectives, being fully capable of preventing a resurgence of terrorism and remaining vigilant against the nuclear dangers of Iran and Pakistan. The resource levels Trump had implicitly approved at the tank briefing were not near what we would need in a major crisis, but in my view, at least we would still have several bases in Afghanistan and the possibility of rapidly scaling up our capabilities. Pompeo and Khalilzad, however, were still negotiating as if we were withdrawing entirely. We may have started there in November, but we had clawed ourselves a long way back, and Shanahan, Dunford, and I feared losing that progress. Within 30 minutes of the breakfast, I called Trump and said it was his decision whether to let Khalilzad and the State Department act with complete independence in the negotiations, but I thought it was dangerous for what Trump said he wanted. "I don't even know who he is," Trump replied of Khalilzad. "Do what you think is best." That same morning, I met with Khalilzad, someone I had known, as I have said, for nearly 30 years. He said Pompeo had ordered him not to communicate with me because I was undermining Pompeo with Trump. That happened to be untrue, and I wondered if Pompeo's real motivation was who would get credit for Afghanistan, a common Washington phenomenon. If true, It was misplaced. I didn't think there was any material chance the negotiations would produce an acceptable result, so I was hardly eager to get credit for the outcome. Khalilzad agreed to an informal meeting with all the officials involved to work out the misunderstandings before he left Washington to resume talks with the Taliban. I thought this was a good decision. Several days later, however, Pompeo called to complain that senior Pentagon officials and Lisa Curtis, the National Security Council's senior director for South Asia, were interfering with Khalilzad and should leave him alone. Normally, such meetings constituted interagency coordination, but Pompeo saw it as meddling. No wonder we had internal administration problems on Afghanistan. In the midst of these difficulties, we received one piece of extraordinarily good news on April 12th when the International Criminal Court's pre-trial chamber handed down a 32-page opinion rejecting its prosecutor's request to open an investigation into the conduct of U.S. military and intelligence personnel in Afghanistan. I spoke several times with former Congressman Pete Hoekstra, our ambassador to the Netherlands, where the court was located in The Hague, and found him nearly as surprised as I that we had succeeded in stopping this miscarriage of justice. I had long opposed the court, and I had given a speech early in my tenure to the Federalist Society in Washington about why the administration rejected it as a matter of principle, and the steps we were prepared to take against the court if it presumed to target American citizens. I called Trump at 9:15 a.m. to tell him about the decision, and he said, "Put out something powerful," which I was delighted to do. As for the U.S. Taliban meetings, I was less concerned than before about their substance, and therefore less exercised than the Pentagon, because I thought we had largely won the key battle in Trump's mind. The United States would not be completely withdrawing from Afghanistan, but would maintain a persistent troop presence for counterterrorism and other objectives. If it turned out Trump reversed course and one day simply said to leave immediately, which he did in outbursts periodically, even that decision didn't depend on the state of play in the talks. In short, the U.S. military posture was no longer tied to the peace process, if it ever had been. Thus, in my mind, there was no particular pressure for Khalilzad to produce results and no target date to finish the negotiations. Yet, by July 1st, defense learned that Khalilzad was about to announce a deal with the Taliban without informing anyone in Washington what was in it. Not unreasonably, Esper called Pompeo, his West Point classmate, to suggest bringing the deal back to Washington for review. Kupperman heard from Esper's chief of staff that Pompeo lit up Esper in no uncertain terms and his subordinates for involving themselves in the Afghan negotiations. Pompeo, often screaming, we were told, said Khalilzad was under instructions, he left unstated by whom, to make a deal without outside supervision. Shanahan had tried to be reasonable and failed, and now it was Esper's turn. When I spoke to him the next day, his concerns were actually more tactical, such as his legitimate interest in the safety of withdrawing U.S. forces, rather than aimed at the policy. Mike got a little animated, Esper put it politely, but as our conversation continued, there was clearly a disjunction between the State Department's objective, zero U.S. forces, and my and the Pentagon's desire to preserve counterterrorism and other capabilities. Esper was rightly concerned with how the actual functioning of military operations would be affected if we lost even a foothold in Afghanistan. I brought this schizophrenia to a head in a discussion with Khalilzad on July 19th. My objective was to reach agreement within the U.S. government from among all the various strands of thought and to resolve the disconnects in our internal deliberations. Specifically, while his instructions from Trump or Pompeo, whomever, at that time were to get U.S. forces to zero, he also had instructions from Trump to support counterterrorism capabilities consistent with what had been previously briefed to Trump in the tank, essentially without an end date. The trick was how to get the Taliban and the Afghan government to agree we were going to zero on the existing mission while simultaneously creating a modified mission to support counterterrorism capabilities. Khalilzad readily agreed, saying he fully understood what Trump expected, so I considered this significant progress. My objective here was ensuring that our government agreed within itself in the context where we found ourselves at that point. We could have done this earlier and more easily if Pompeo had let Khalilzad have these conversations more often and we didn't have to arrange them like spy encounters. In any case, the Taliban talks continued apace through the summer. On Wednesday, August 14th, Kupperman first heard from Esper's chief of staff about a Friday meeting on Afghanistan at Trump's Bedminster Golf Club, where he was staying for about a week. That was news to us, so at 7:10 a.m. the next morning, I called Mulvaney, who was also in New Jersey, to see what was up. He said he had heard about a Friday meeting and asked Westerhout about it. She said it was with the guy from Afghanistan, meaning Khalilzad, and Pompeo. "You can come," said Mulvaney. "Is the Defense Department coming?" I said I thought so, and the call ended. All this showed yet again how state was treating the rest of the national security team. I had no doubt the Taliban were increasingly happy about the terms of the emerging deal, most of which I believed they had little intention of following. I suspected Pompeo wanted Trump to sign off with the minimal internal opposition possible, but the endless negotiations had produced a result I and many others believed would have severe negative consequences for America. The National Security Advisor's job is to coordinate between state, defense, and other NSC members. If I couldn't perform this role, there was no point in staying. In the meantime, at least I had succeeded in getting invited. I spoke with Pompeo later that morning, raising the Bedminster gathering among other issues. He said we were not done with the negotiations, like the nature of the ceasefire, the overall reduction in violence from the Taliban, and the counterterrorism mission, all of which were unresolved. I said I was flying up for the meeting, probably on Air Force 2 with Pence, and asked when he was going up. You could have heard a pin drop. He obviously had not anticipated that a small army of people would be attending the Bedminster meeting, and certainly not me. It turned out that Haspel, Cipollone, Mark Short, the VP's chief of staff, and Kellogg also attended, along with Mulvaney, Esper, and Dunford. Lindsey Graham called me, having heard about the Bedminster meeting, and stressed to Trump on Wednesday the need for a residual force to counter the terrorist threat and other purposes. Nonetheless, he was very worried about press reports indicating the deal with the Taliban contained no such provisions, and he asked me to speak with Jack Keane, the retired four-star general who was a regular commentator on Fox. I called Keane while waiting to take off from Andrews and urged him to call Trump directly, since he and Trump spoke frequently about such issues. If there was ever a time for Keane to talk to Trump on Afghanistan, this was it. Pence asked me to join him in his cabin for the flight, and I explained the risks in the proposed deal as best I understood it, as well as the considerable political downside for Trump, noting that Graham and others were already outspoken in their views. We landed at the Morristown, New Jersey airport and motorcaded to Bedminster. The meeting began shortly after 3 p.m., with Pompeo saying, "We are not quite done with the Taliban," but then laying out the broad terms of a deal that sounded almost done. This description contrasted sharply with what Pompeo had said to me on the phone earlier that day. Trump asked questions, especially about one provision for an exchange of prisoners and hostages between the Taliban and the Afghan government, which in numerical terms looked a lot more favorable to the Taliban than to us. Trump didn't like that at all. Then Trump began riffing about Afghan President Ghani and his elaborate house in Dubai, which we knew from actual research Ghani didn't own. But no matter, because Pompeo pointed out the reality that Ghani was now president and controlled the government's armed forces. Completely predictably, Trump asked, "Who pays them?" Esper, new to this movie script, promptly responded, "We do," thereby launching Trump into the riff about how Mattis always said, These soldiers are fighting bravely for their country, until Trump asked who paid for them and found out the total cost, including equipment and other supplies, was about $6.5 billion annually. They are the most highly paid soldiers in the world, Trump concluded. Then he was off on green-on-blue attacks, where Afghan government soldiers attacked U.S. forces. We teach them how to shoot, and then they take the weapons and say, "Oh, thank you, sir," and then kill our guys. Then we were off to the Afghan elections and a reprise on why Trump didn't like this or that senior Afghan official. If only Trump could keep it straight that incumbent President Ghani was not former President Karzai, we could have spared ourselves a lot of trouble. As the discussion proceeded, Trump said at one point, "Making a bad deal is worse than just getting out. I'd rather not make a deal." I thought this comment provided a glimmer of hope. But before we got too far, Trump shifted again, complaining about leaks, including that CNN had earlier reported this very meeting. "These people should be executed. They are scumbags," he said, but then observed it was not a bad thing that the news was out, that we were talking about Afghanistan. This led to one of Trump's favorite legal gambits, namely that the Justice Department arrest the reporters, force them to serve time in jail, and then demand they disclose their sources. Only then would the leaks stop. Trump told Cipollone to call Barr about it, which Cipollone said he would do. Trump went on, "I like my message. If they come at us, we're going to destroy their whole nation. Not with nuclear weapons, though. They hate us, too. Taliban wants their land. We went in to take their land, and they've got crooks in the highest levels of government." The conversation continued, but I sensed Trump was increasingly distant from it. Something was bothering him, but I couldn't tell what. Suddenly, off to the races again. "I want to get out of everything," he said, criticizing our military programs in Africa, as Esper and Dunford hastened to assure him they were already being reduced. Then it was back to the 2018 NATO summit and how he threatened to withdraw, which was not quite true, and how much we spent in Ukraine. Then he again recounted his first conversation with Angela Merkel and how even before congratulating him for winning, Merkel had asked what he was going to do about Ukraine. Trump had replied by asking Merkel what she was going to do about Ukraine. Then he asked, "Do we really want Fort Trump in Poland?" I said he had agreed to it in several conversations with Polish President Andrzej Duda, that the Poles were paying for its construction, and that he was going to Poland on September 1st to commemorate the 80th anniversary of the Nazi invasion, which didn't slow him down. He said he didn't remember agreeing to Fort Trump, which reflected on either his memory or his ability to disregard whatever he didn't want to remember. Esper tried to explain that troops in Poland would be rotational rather than permanent, but Trump was off to his next point, the ongoing war games in South Korea. "You shouldn't have let them go on," he said to me, notwithstanding that he had agreed to them, knowing they were tabletop exercises, not field maneuvers. "I'm trying to make peace with a psycho," he said, which at least acknowledged that Kim Jong-un might be somewhat problematic. "The war games are a big mistake. I never should have agreed to the exercises," he finally said. "Get out of there if we don't get the $5 billion deal for South Korean support of U.S. bases. We lose $38 billion in trade in Korea. Let's get out." He asked several times when the current exercises ended, which was on August 20th, and he said, "End them in 2 days. Don't extend them even for a day." As if he had already decided to approve the Pompeo-Khalilzad deal, Trump said, "Let's make a big deal about it, like it's a wonderful deal. If they do anything bad," which I understood to mean if Taliban broke the agreement, "we're going to blow their fucking country into a million pieces." I did not take this to be a well-thought-out military strategy, but simply typical Trump analysis. "And I don't blame the military because you weren't given the tools." This last point would have surprised Mattis, to whom Trump had constantly said he had done just that. Then it was off on the subject of Greenland, but quickly back to Africa. I want out of Africa and as many other places as you can. I want our soldiers on our soil. Take them out of Germany. I'm going to tell Germany, you have to pay immediately. Then it was back to Fort Trump, and Esper tried for a second time to explain that U.S. troops there would be rotating in and out, not actually stationed there. I got elected on getting out of Afghanistan and these war games. Then he said, we have 52,000 troops in Europe. People are so enamored with NATO. Then, switching to Kashmir, I want to call Modi on Monday, he said. We have tremendous power because of trade. Pence tried to return the conversation to announcing the Afghan deal, asking if it should be next week. Trump said, don't mention withdrawal in the statement, but say we will go to zero in October 2020, right before the election. We could push it past the election. How does it look politically? Dunford said we could decrease to the proposed resource levels Trump had been briefed on in the tank, discussed earlier, and just stop there. Pompeo again pushed for a commitment to zero in the agreement because the Taliban insisted on it. That was the heart of the problem. I said, near the meeting's end, that I hadn't actually seen the text of the agreement, and Pompeo said, it's true we've held this very tight, but we will have leaks as soon as we broaden the distribution. That was another problem. Pompeo tried to keep the whole thing between himself, Khalilzad, and Trump, although, as the meeting started, Trump said it had been a long time since he had seen Khalilzad. By keeping it so tight, Pompeo guaranteed he owned it entirely. That was fine with me. If that's what he and Trump wanted, they could have the political blowback to themselves. The meeting ended about 4:50 p.m. without a decision on whether there would be a statement next week or not. In part, that was because significant issues were still unresolved, if they could be resolved at all. On Monday, I met Khalilzad at his request to follow up the Bedminster meeting. He and Pompeo had clearly taken Friday's outcome to mean they had carte blanche to continue negotiating, which, as I told Khalilzad, I thought overstated their writ. In any case, I had little doubt that Trump reserved the right to reject anything he didn't like, right up to and even after the last minute. Khalilzad first wanted me to read the documents that were mostly agreed, but he couldn't leave copies behind. I said thanks, but handed the documents back to him unread, saying there was no way I was going to be rushed on these things. I wanted time to study the documents, and I didn't alter my view even after Khalilzad said Esper, Dunford, and Haspel had all agreed to this proposed approach. He seemed stunned I wouldn't go along, but I was quite clear I wasn't going to consume in 10 minutes something he and Pompeo had worked on for 10 months. I said I couldn't, for the life of me, figure out Pompeo's desire to hold all this so tightly, using preventing leaks as an argument never to show it to anyone. Why, I asked, given that we all knew the political risks on this deal were from most Republicans, let alone Democrats, didn't Pompeo want allies? If he wanted all the credit for it, I could understand that, but there would be precious little credit when the agreement collapsed, which even Pompeo told me he thought was inevitable. What was the logic? Khalilzad didn't answer, I suspect because he also didn't understand why he operated under so many Pompeo-imposed constraints. We next discussed what would happen in the negotiations. I explained why a conditions-based withdrawal linked to U.S. forces going to zero was inherently unlikely to see the conditions actually met. We could repeat the phrase conditions-based all we wanted, but in reality, this agreement would be regarded as pulling up stakes and getting out, which Trump probably would have preferred, even though none of the rest of us did, with all the attendant chaos that would likely follow. Khalilzad understood, but said this was the best we could do. My strong personal opinion was that I was still prepared to reduce forces to some extent without any deal, albeit unhappily, because while those levels previously briefed to Trump would be the best we could get from him, I remained convinced they were too low. Nonetheless, Khalilzad said he still thought Trump and certainly Pompeo wanted a signed document, period. Always hoping for the best, I asked Khalilzad to stay in touch once he got back to the negotiations. At a lunch later that day with Esper and me, Pompeo said he read Trump as being uneasy, which was not far from my own take. Trump didn't want to stop the negotiations, but he was clearly worried he was exposing himself to more political risks than he had anticipated, and perhaps for no good reason. A few days later, on August 27th, Pompeo reached me in Kiev to say Khalilzad had everything wrapped up and expected to bring back the final documents. Interestingly, he thought Trump was leaning toward my option of reducing forces to the counterterrorism mission level, 8,600, which even Trump was now using in public, without signing the deal. Pompeo thought Trump appreciated how devastating it would be to see the zero level in writing, especially with all the conditions-based language somewhere out in the weeds, which was certainly my analysis and what I had argued as strenuously as I could at Bedminster. As to whether the military could live without the protection of a deal, Pompeo said he thought the U.S. commander would prefer a deal, but could live with it either way. That clinched it for me. Trump also said in a radio interview with Fox's Brian Kilmeade, "We're going to keep a presence there. We're reducing that presence very substantially, and we're always going to have a presence. We're going to have high intelligence, but we're bringing it down if the deal happens. I don't know that it's going to happen. You know my attitude on those things, Brian." On August 29th, I called Pompeo from my plane on the way to Warsaw, and he said his phone had lit up with NATO foreign ministers and Stoltenberg as Trump made those remarks. Later that day, because of Hurricane Dorian, Trump canceled his visit to Poland, saying Pence would instead lead our delegation. Therefore, what turned out to be a key meeting on Afghanistan took place on Friday, August 30th, with Pence linked up from the outside, Khalilzad connected from Doha, I think, yours truly participating via video conference from Warsaw, and all the other attendees in the sit room, including Kupperman, who later gave me the mood in the room. We were scheduled to cover not just Afghanistan, but also Ukraine, so there was a lot riding on this call, which did not actually begin until 8:45 p.m. Warsaw time. This was a fine irony, since the ever-diligent Washington Post was about to publish, and did, a story saying I was excluded from key Afghanistan meetings. These people were a piece of work. The initial discussion sounded much like the one in Bedminster, with Trump opining, "The Taliban just want their land back," and confusing President Ghani with former President Karzai and their respective net worths. "Would you sign it, John?" Trump then asked, and I said, "I would not, Mr. President." I explained again my reasons why Trump should just go down to 8,600 service members plus associated and coalition forces if that's what he wanted to do, and then wait and await further developments, such as the Afghan elections. There was no way to trust the Taliban and no enforcement mechanism. This was not a New York real estate deal. Khalilzad then explained this was the deal Trump had said he wanted. Esper said he thought I made a lot of good points, but the Defense Department wanted the deal because, after all, it was conditions-based. Trump posed what was always his key question: how bad will this deal make me look? The Democrats would trash a great agreement. Esper suggested bringing in Hill leaders for consultations. Trump asked, "Is this agreement saleable?" And I said I didn't think so, largely because, in my view, the Taliban wouldn't adhere to it, and everyone knew it. Then Trump blew the whole meeting away by saying, "I want to speak to the Taliban. Let them come to Washington." I could not have been happier that I was in a secure room deep in Eastern Europe rather than in the sit room when I heard that statement. Trump asked Pence what he thought, and Pence replied carefully, "We should reflect before we make that decision. They have abused and oppressed their people. Have they actually changed?" Trump then referred to Billy Graham's grandson a major who had served in Afghanistan, who said, "We took their land." "Why is he only a major?" Trump asked Dunford. "He's good-looking, right from central casting." We then discussed how Congress would react to a U.S. commitment to withdrawing our troops completely and what we were going to do with the duly elected Afghan government, whatever Trump's views on Ghani. Trump said, "I want Ghani here too, as well as the Taliban. Let's do it before it's signed. I want to meet before it's signed, not a phone call."
"They'd love to come," said Khalilzad.
"Hey, John," Trump said to the screen in the sit room, "what do you think?" My instinct was that this meeting could stop the pending deal in its tracks while the Taliban and the Afghan government wrestled with its implications, or at least delay it for a significant enough period because of the time it would take for the Afghan parties to figure out their positions. That would give us time to find some other way to tank the deal. So I said, "Okay by me, as long as they have to pass through the world's most powerful magnetometer before they meet with you."
"And chemical," said Trump correctly.
Only Trump could conceive of a president of the United States meeting with these thugs, but by so doing, he was threatening the very deal Pompeo was pushing.
"Maybe they will or they won't come," said Trump.
"We need to think it through," said Pompeo. Pence asked, "Would you meet with Ghani first?"
"Only if Ghani knows I'm also going to sit down with the Taliban later," said Trump.
Trump's next thought was to start reducing troop levels immediately. No one supported the idea, although only Khalilzad spoke against it. Trump said, "Our attitude is, I'm not looking to get out. I will meet with Ghani first. This could be a home run. The Taliban would like to talk to Donald Trump to talk peace. We should say to the press that the president has agreed to a meeting and he's looking forward to the meeting." I could sense, even through my remote connection, and Kupperman agreed later, that Pompeo and others in the sit room were close to meltdown. Pence added, "to meet with Ghani and others in the Afghan government." And Trump agreed, "yes, and before the meeting with the Taliban." With that, Trump got up and started to leave. I all but yelled from Warsaw, "What about Ukraine?" And the meeting moved to that subject, which I will describe at length in the next chapter. I concluded after the call that Trump had suggested meeting the Taliban because he was looking for alternatives to signing the Pompeo-Khalilzad deal. Obviously, he didn't fully agree with me that he shouldn't sign it, but he saw the clear political risks, if nothing else, if he did sign it. Faced with that unhappy choice, he reached for something to avoid the dilemma and to find an option to put him in the starring role. What could go wrong? The battle roared on. Back in Washington, Kupperman heard from Dan Walsh, a Mulvaney deputy, on the Wednesday after Labor Day that Trump wanted the Taliban and Ghani meetings at Camp David. I had mistakenly put the arrangements for this meeting out of mind, assuming the logistics would be so complicated that delay was inevitable, not to mention the chance Taliban leaders would smell a trap and reject the invitation entirely. So the idea things had progressed to the point where Camp David was Trump's preference was truly disheartening. I didn't want the meetings, and I didn't want the deal, and now it seemed we might get both. The next day, September 5th, Mulvaney came to my office just before 8 a.m. to tell me personally this was where things were headed. He planned to go up to Camp David with Trump on Saturday and suggested I come up on Sunday with the rest of the gang, Pompeo, Esper, Dunford, and Khalilzad. Pompeo was handling travel arrangements for the Taliban, and the Qataris were flying in the Taliban thugs. Also interesting was that Pompeo seemed to be backing away from the deal, perhaps finally realizing there was political danger for him in continuing to be the deal's strongest supporter. Walsh was apoplectic about the physical dangers of this exercise and the lack of time to plan adequately, but Trump was determined to proceed. He worried that too intrusive security measures would offend the Taliban's dignity. This precipitated chaotic early morning meetings among the rest of us to discuss how to protect Trump from his dignified guests,
One thing Mulvaney, Kupperman, Walsh, and I all agreed on was that Pence was not going to Camp David no matter what. There is much I cannot describe here, but suffice it to say that, with one exception, no one in the West Wing was enthusiastic about this frolic. Amid these conversations, we heard reports from Afghanistan about a suicide bombing in Kabul, with 10 killed, including one American and one Romanian service member, and several wounded. It was almost certainly a Taliban attack, although given Iran's recent activity in Afghanistan, it could have been a joint effort. Mulvaney came into my office a little before 9 a.m. to say, "If my Trumpometer reading is accurate, I think there's at least a 20% chance he will cancel the Sunday meeting." He, Trump, said immediately, "We can't do the meeting," which sounded like more than 20% to me. I pointed out, not that it probably wasn't too late, that once Trump met with Ghani and the Taliban, he would own this deal beyond any chance of separating himself from it when things went wrong. In fact, commentary was already growing about how bad the underlying deal was, even though no one outside the administration knew anything about a Taliban meeting, let alone one at Camp David. Thus, there was at least a chance to postpone things further, with the rising attendant possibility of killing the agreement entirely. Moreover, if the meeting proceeded, it would be on September 8th, 3 days before the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks by Al-Qaeda, to which the Taliban had given aid and comfort. How could anyone have missed that? Mulvaney and I agreed to see Trump as early as possible, which turned out to be 11:45, with Pompeo and others, including, for some unknown reason, Mnuchin. Almost before we sat down in the Oval, Trump said, "Don't take the meeting." Put out a statement that says, "We had a meeting scheduled, but they killed one of our soldiers and 9 others, so we canceled it. There should be a ceasefire, or I don't want to negotiate. We should drop a bomb, hit them hard. If they can't do a ceasefire, I don't want an agreement." That pretty well settled that. Pompeo and I spoke after he was back at the State Department to see if his understanding was the same as mine, that not only the Taliban, but also the Ghani meeting was canceled, and he agreed that's what he'd heard Trump say. We also concluded, as Mulvaney and I had, that we should make no statement about not meeting the Taliban. Much better to say nothing and hope the possibility never became public. There were media reports in Afghanistan already about Ghani's coming to Washington, but U.S. press stories hadn't picked up the real reason. Maybe it would stay that way. Of course not. On Saturday evening, September 7th, with no warning, Trump tweeted, "Unbeknownst to almost everyone, the major Taliban leaders and, separately, the president of Afghanistan were going to secretly meet with me at Camp David on Sunday. They were coming to the United States tonight. Unfortunately, in order to build false leverage, they admitted to an attack in Kabul that killed one of our great-great soldiers and 11 other people. I immediately canceled the meeting and called off peace negotiations. What kind of people would kill so many in order to seemingly strengthen their bargaining position? They didn't. They only made it worse. If they cannot agree to a ceasefire during these very important peace talks and would even kill 12 innocent people, then they probably don't have the power to negotiate a meaningful agreement anyway. How many more decades are they willing to fight?" He couldn't restrain himself. The Sunday media were flooded with accounts of the near disaster of Camp David. The Taliban brashly claimed the U.S. would be harmed more than anyone by canceling the meeting, which was totally false, but it also meant Afghanistan's September 28th presidential election would now go forward, which it did. Neither the incumbent, President Ghani, nor Afghanistan's chief executive, Abdullah Abdullah, received an absolute majority, necessitating a runoff, likely to be scheduled in 2020. Thus, unfortunately, rather than strengthening the government's hand, the runoff requirement introduced new political uncertainty. Nonetheless, the determination of Afghans who wanted an elected government rather than theocratic rule remained strong, which added at least some muscle to those determined to avoid a sellout to the Taliban. This was effectively the last of my involvement in Afghanistan. Since I resigned, Trump resumed talks with the Taliban, which were just as detrimental to the United States as before. Combined, however, with the October withdrawal debacle in Syria, a clear, unforced error by Trump personally, political opposition to surrendering in Afghanistan grew stronger. Nonetheless, on Saturday, February 29, 2020, the United States and the Taliban signed an agreement that, in my view, looked very much like the agreement that had come unstuck in September. This still being the Twitter presidency, I tweeted my opposition that morning. Signing this agreement with Taliban is an unacceptable risk to America's civilian population. This is an Obama-style deal. Legitimizing the Taliban sends the wrong signal to ISIS and Al-Qaeda terrorists and to America's enemies generally. Trump responded in typical fashion at a press conference a few hours later, saying of me, "He had his chance. He didn't do it." The preceding chapter demonstrates, to the contrary, that this Afghanistan deal is entirely Trump's. Time will prove who is right, and the full effects of the deal may not become apparent until after Trump leaves office. But there should be no mistaking this reality. Trump will be responsible for the consequences, politically and militarily.